5, Washington State Wildlife Action Plan. This is a briefing swap, so Penny, back to you again. And Lynn.
You aren't tired of me yet. We got one more. So I have Lynn Helbrecht with me, and she was essentially the star of helping to coordinate our State Wildlife Action Plan for the last couple of years. And we really wanted to spend some time today to orient you to the State Wildlife Action Plan now that we have a version that's been sent off to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and talk about some new tools for advancing conservation that's within the State Wildlife Action Plan that really can help us move forward on a conservation of some of those species that we just talked about, the threatened and endangered ones, as well as a bunch of other species that we want to keep common. And then finally, we want to review the public comments that we heard through the revision process with you. So as you'll remember, when we came to you last year, the State Wildlife Action Plan is connected to the State Wildlife Grants Program. And the State Wildlife Grants are awarded annually, and WDFW gets approximately $1.2 million throughout the agency to be able to do conservation of those species. To be eligible, you have to have the State Wildlife Action Plan. And so that action plan essentially cues up, here's the broad spectrum of things that you can work on within your state wildlife grant. So pick the species and the habitats that are from that State Wildlife Action Plan for your grant. The first swaps were approved in 2005, and they have to be updated every 10 years, which is why last year we were working on finishing our revision to get up to speed, and we made it just under the wire for our submission with a couple days early. It was a significant investment for our staff to do this revision of the State Wildlife Action Plan. It really required us to do a comprehensive review of all the species in our state, and as well as the habitats, and determine which ones are of greatest conservation need. So a prioritization process there. Just as a reminder, so we've got 268 species that are currently are going to be on this within this new State Wildlife Action Plan. And many of the new species that we added from last time were invertebrates, as you'll remember. So we know a lot more about invertebrates than we did 10 years ago, and we continue to keep learning and finding there's a lot more need there. We also have 30 ecological systems or habitats of greatest conservation needs. So these are the areas that we don't have a lot left of that are in peril in their own right. We take that a step further for those habitats and species and determine what are the threats and conservation actions that are needed for those, and outline an approach for monitoring and adaptive management of those conservation actions as we go forward. And we also provided for both public involvement and stakeholder engagement in order to get the revision done. So the State Wildlife Action Plan is intended to be a guide to inform our strategic plans, our work plans, and our priorities. So, you know, as we said, there's 268 species and so many habitats. It's a wide sort of assessment of what we have in Washington State, and it's meant to be a guide for us to pull from. So when we're doing our work plans, we select things from there as our priorities. So it's a broad plan that we use to inform lots of other strategic plans, our recovery plans, you name it. It highlights conservation needs and provides some new tools that we're working on continually to address those needs. And the reason we added a lot of public input and participation is that, yes, WDFW is the primary audience for us to use this plan, but also, you know, as Sean stated before, that's part of our intention is to show what the needs are for these species so that we can better partner with other organizations to do the work. Certainly, DFW can't do it all on our own.
Okay, hello. Good morning, everybody. So I want to start now talk highlight a few of these tools and resources in the plan. As Penny mentioned, we were required to do this plan, and it was a significant effort. And so our interest was in leveraging that investment and making sure that as we prepared these required elements, that we were doing it in such a way as to add value back to the agency by developing some of these tools that we can use. So I want to start by showing you what the document looks like. It's a big beast. It's about 1,000 pages, and we've divided it into three volumes. Volume one is much of the narrative of the document. Volume two has fact sheets for every one of these species of greatest conservation need. And then volume three has a number of our appendices and supporting material. And much as you might want to, this is not designed to be read from start to finish. We've really designed it so that you can go where you're interested and pick and choose the tool or the component that most interests you. So each of these pieces pretty much will stand on its own. So the first thing I want to talk about is that Appendix A. And I mentioned there's fact sheets there for each one of our species of greatest conservation need. And these are high-level, two-page summaries, sort of an at-a-glance. Why is this critter on our species of greatest conservation need list? What's the concern? These are the bullets there are the topics we highlight in these very succinct summaries. And kind of the opposite of some of the work you just heard about, where we go into a great deal of detail. Here it's, let's get a bird's eye view. Here's an example of what one of these looks like. It's the Cascade Torrent Salamander, and you can just pay attention to the bold headings there to see the kinds of information we highlight. And that first heading there is again, that summary of why is this a species of greatest conservation need. The table there, at a glance, does it have federal status? No, it is a state candidate species. It is on the priority and habitat species list. A couple of rankings there for how imperiled it is on some different scales. What we know about the population size and the trend, and then if we have information about the vulnerability to climate change. The second page goes into a little more detail about the threats and the conservation actions that are needed, and let me walk you through this. So for this salamander, for example, this first threat is around a lack of information on status and distribution. The action needed is to continue the work that's underway for research and survey and monitoring. And these last two categories are kind of interesting. So we asked folks, the biologists who prepared these, to identify the level of investment. So for this particular threat and action, the level of investment was considered current insufficient. We're doing the right thing, but not enough resources. They could have also picked the current sufficient. We got what we need. It's underway. Let us go. Or we don't have any action here whatsoever. New actions needed. That next column there is the lead, and this is just a very high-level look at who's in the driver's seat here. Is this a WDFW lead, or is it really shared with external partners, feds, NGOs, academia, et cetera? So this is how the rest of this chart lays out for this particular animal. And we've done this, as I've mentioned, for each one of our species of greatest conservation need. And as painful as this was for staff to prepare all this information, the advantage of having collected all of this data in this format is that then we have opportunities to roll up the information and synthesize it in interesting ways. So here's an example of that. So this is that level of investment question. And for all of the threats that we identified for all of the species of greatest conservation need, you can see here it's sort of a good news, bad news story in my mind. So for the vast majority, we're on the right track. We know what needs to happen. We're underway. We just need to find ways to bring more resources to that effort. So the current insufficient there. And then again, I mentioned this other category of information about the lead. This is another interesting one for me, and it's probably not a surprise to any of you here, but what it tells us that for, the vast majority, these are collaborative actions, and the need is collaborative. So it's so important for us to keep those relationships strong with our conservation partners. The next set of tools I want to talk about have to do with habitat and how we defined and classified habitat in this version of the SWAP is very different than we did in the older version. We adopted a new classification system called the National Vegetation Classification, and we did that for two reasons. Number one, a number of our partners are using this classification for delineating habitat, our federal partners, et cetera. So by using this way to talk about habitat, we can start to have more of the same language. And secondly, these vegetation classifications are mapped. all across the West and certainly in Washington. So it gives us a potentially powerful tool for our conservation actions. What you're seeing here in this slide is the very coarsest level of that particular classification, 18 big categories across the state, major habitat types. The dark green is temperate forest, obviously a very big one. The light buff color, herbaceous agricultural lands, and then the darker buff color, shrub steppe, just to point out a few. And this is a page right from the SWAP, and so each of those major habitat types, and you see an example there on the left column, also has a number of ecological systems that are nested within that. And that's really the key for us. These are the systems, and the description of these ecological systems and the vegetation within them is what we correlated back to the habitat needs for our SGCN. In this particular page here, the blue highlighted bars indicate those systems that are of concern, that are considered imperiled from a conservation perspective. And then I don't know if you can see it on the slide here, but we've also starred those systems that came out as highly vulnerable when we did our climate analysis. So this was another big piece of work that I think is going to have big payoffs for us. All 268 SGCN have been associated with one or more, in most cases, many of those ecological systems. And we've done those in two ways. One is it's considered closely associated, and so this represents primary habitat, very necessary for this animal's survival for one or more part of its life history, or generally associated. It uses the habitat, but not essential. So let me show you what this allows us to do. Here's just one example of looking at this information now that we have done that association. So what you see at the bottom are those large habitat categories, the big 18 categories that stretch across Washington. And then the blue bars represent the number of SGCN that are closely associated with the ecological systems within that habitat type. The red bars are generally the number of SGCN that are generally associated. And the small green bars are the number of ecological systems of concern. And so, for example, looking at that temperate forest there, you begin to get a sense, it's sort of a bang for the buck kind of question, where we're working, in what habitats are we going to get the most value, going to address the most critical needs. So you can see certainly for temperate forest, and there's a lot of ecological systems within that, that makes sense. What's also interesting to me is looking at the left side of this graph, or this figure, where you see a lot of those red bars, and you have a lot of the more human-modified, vegetation systems on that side are more like land cover types in this case. So, for example, developed and urban, a lot of animals are using that habitat generally associated. We can't discount it. We can't write it off. We need to continue working with conservation partners to make sure we're bringing attention to those habitats. The same data set helped us to prepare new sets of range and habitat distribution maps for a number of our species, and we're pretty excited about this one. Here's an example of a completed map, its potential range and habitat distribution for the sagebrush sparrow. And I want to tell you a little bit about how we came up with these maps, and I'm going to zero in on the legend down there. The purple lines represent watersheds of known occurrence. So these are documented observances that are in our database for each SGCN. And then we've drawn a larger line around that, a bigger geography that represents potential range. If it's in that watershed, it might be in the neighboring one, if there's suitable habitat. And down there, again, you see that same data set that we're making use of again. Habitat suitability is defined as these closely associated ecological systems, which have been mapped across the West, so it's a great data source for us, or generally associated. And so here we go back to this map. So the purple indicates those watersheds where we have documented occurrences. The black is that broader geography. And then you can see the blue represents potentially suitable habitat, the red generally associated habitat. So these maps, we're looking forward to getting these out on the street and using them with our own staff across the agency. They can help us to narrow in where we want to do species surveys, for example, or guiding restoration efforts. And we have these for not all of the SGCN, for those only that we had enough data for, so about 85 of these maps. The last tool I want to talk about is the work that we did to address climate change in the context of the State Wildlife Action Plan. And when we first launched into this effort, our goal was not to have a separate chapter for climate change. We know that climate change doesn't stand alone as a threat. It generally will work to exacerbate existing threats to these animals, as you heard about this morning. So we wanted to figure out if we could We know that it's going to affect certain animals more than others. So for which animals is climate a significant threat? Where is it that we need to pay particular attention and guide our actions accordingly? And if it is a significant factor, what should we do differently? So that was our goal. And what we realized that we didn't quite know enough to get there for all of these 268 species. Some of our species we know quite a bit about, as you heard again this morning, some of the listed species, some of the well-studied species. But as Penny mentioned, part of the goal of this program is to bring conservation attention to a greater breadth of species, those that are not yet endangered, but that may become endangered. So there's a number of animals on this list where we don't know that much about. So we needed to assess the vulnerability of all the SGCN and build a baseline database for what we know, what the literature tells us about the vulnerability to climate change of these animals. And we do this in two ways. We start with the inherent sensitivity, and I want to take a moment to explain this to you because I think it's really important to understand what the data means. So we talk first about the inherent sensitivity of an animal to climatic change. So for example, bull trout might be very sensitive to changes, have a very limited thermal tolerance. The other side of the equation is the exposure. So, okay, we know that the animal might be sensitive, but is it going to experience that change? What's the likelihood that bull trout is going to experience warmer temperatures? And the two of those together indicate vulnerability. And so it's important to separate these notions out because they help us to find out if we have uncertainty, is it around the sensitivity or is the uncertainty around what the climate data? And that's the other piece we added to our assessment here was a sense of the confidence that we had for each of these two separate components. So did we have a lot of data sources? Were we fairly confident in making our determination? Or not so much, and we want to sort of tee that up for more research. Same thing with the climate data on the exposure side. So we did that work. We got a small amount of funding from the North Pacific Landscape Conservation Cooperative, which was a great help. And we now have a climate vulnerability database for all 268 SGCN and 30 of our ecological systems, and we're working on building that. So to some extent, this enables us to answer this question, which SGCN are most vulnerable to climate change and why? And this is a really, really important piece of the puzzle. Now I feel like we have a good base so that we can begin to dive into those highly vulnerable species and better understand what we can do to mitigate the climate change threat. The why is very important here because the why helps us understand if there's anything that we can do, why it's sensitive, what the exposure is, and what opportunities there might be. So I want to give you two examples of how this plays out. So again, we have this information developed for all of our SGCN. Here's an example from the lynx. We know that it's sensitive. So when we look at its inherent sensitivity, we know it's very dependent on cold, high elevation habitat. It's dependent on snowpack for prey availability. So we assessed it as a very highly sensitive, and we have a high degree of confidence in making that determination. Lots of references. We also know that on the exposure side, we can compare the range of the lynx with the range of the maps that we get from the climate impacts groups and other climate scientists, and we can see that the snowpack is projected for dramatic decreases across the lynx range. So yes, the exposure, the likelihood that it's going to experience that climatic change is high, and we have a fairly high degree of confidence. We have good range maps for the animal, and we have good maps from the climate science side of it. So overall, we rated this animal high. High vulnerability and high confidence. On the other side of the issue is the peregrine falcon. So the peregrine falcon we ranked as low in terms of sensitivity. It tends to be a generalist, forages on a diversity of species, and we couldn't really identify any particular climatic factors on which it was really dependent. So for the exposure side, since we couldn't identify any climatic factors, we said, well, yeah, it's pretty low. We don't think it's going to experience any changes that might affect its survival. So this vulnerability of this species was low, and we had a pretty high degree of confidence. Been lots of reference material here. And so the database itself is going to be useful to staff as we start preparing, informing recovery plans, preparing grants, things of that nature. But it also lets us aggregate the information in interesting ways. And so I want to show you how, just for one taxa group, so for the birds, how it plays out here. What you're seeing here in this chart is in the on the right side is high vulnerability to climate change. On the left side is low vulnerability. The top of the graph is a high degree of confidence about that determination, and the bottom is a low degree of confidence about that determination. So here's how the birds fall out, the birds that were SGCN. And you can see that up here in the top right-hand corner, spruce grouse, white-tailed ptarmigan, two alpine-dependent species. We have a high degree of confidence that those are going to be highly vulnerable to climate change. So as we dive into recovery actions for those species or prepare management plans, prepare for grants, we want to make sure that we're considering the threat of climate change is very key to what faces that species. These in the middle here, likely to be high. I'm calling all of this information a work in progress because I fully expect that as we get a more robust data set, we may be moving some of these animals around. Some of these are probably going to move up into the high confidence, moderate to high vulnerability for these animals as we learn more. Down here, we think they're pretty vulnerable, but we don't have a lot of data either for the range maps of the species or for some of the expected impacts. So this might be a good place for more monitoring, citizen science, et cetera. And then over here in this corner, you see our friend the peregrine falcon up there. Probably there are other stressors at play here that are far more important than climate, and we can kind of not have to worry about it. So it lets us see climate is not going to impact all habitats uniformly, and it's not going to impact all species uniformly. And I think it really helps us develop a more nuanced approach when we can try and identify which are the highest vulnerable species. And again, we took, for each of the taxa groups, we took the SGCN that ranked moderate to high or high in vulnerability and a high degree of confidence, and we decided to call those our climate watch species. So this is a preliminary climate watch list, and you can see the two birds there, the spruce grouse and the white-tailed ptarmigan are on there. And then you can see that from the other taxa groups, a lot of our salmonids, are the mid-Columbia salmonids are on there. These are the ones that ranked high, and for which we had high confidence. So I want to remind you that it doesn't mean that those other animals might not also be at risk. It means that we need to shore up our data sources before we're going to say that that's so. We wanted to be conservative, if anything, in these rankings. So that's a little high level view of some of the tools and resources that we're excited about in the swap.
Okay. And then lastly, just to wrap up, we wanted to let you know some of the things we heard during our public comment period. And so we received several comments from external reviewers. In particular, a lot of people wanted to add additional species on our Species of Greatest Conservation Need list. And we heard a lot about, you added a lot of insects, but there's a lot more insects that really need to be added. And in particular, there's been a lot of focus on pollinators as needing a lot of conservation help nationwide. So it was definitely something that was heard through our public comment responses. And in a lot of cases, to respond to that, we went over the reasons why we determined whether the species was on the list or not. In some cases, yes, there might be a localized concern for that species, but we were really looking at statewide. So that either made the difference whether it would be on the list or not. To highlight the pollinators, we actually created a section to focus just on those in broad terms and talk about how important they are and the conservation actions that should be done to conserve them better. And then we're working on preparing a document that summarizes all those comments and provides response. And then that will be posted with the final document once we have approval from the Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's what we're awaiting now, these many months. They're working on reviewing all these state wildlife action plans from all 50 states plus some territories. So they're working through that process. Once we have it, we'll be able to put our final state wildlife action plan on the webpage. Right now, the version that's up there is the one that we've sent off to the service. And really, we're working on implementation, right? So all those actions within the State Wildlife Action Plan, the high-priority ones we're focusing on, we're working on training up staff to use a bunch of the tools that were created over this revision process. So what does the range map mean? How can I use that range map to determine where I do habitat conservation for this species? What's the climate change information mean, and how can that be used in a practical sense? And really looking at establishing additional priorities from all this good information that we've been able to pull together in one place. Any questions?
Well, that's a lot of information.
1,000 pages.
Yeah, 1,000 pages. We stayed to 1,000 pages.
Tried to overwhelm us with that.
Yes.
Just wanted to compliment you on the work that you've done. I always appreciate Lynn's presentations. It's always impressive the way you're bringing in climate change considerations in a very practical, sensible way. So, but this is very impressive with the new GIS mapping tools, the big data tools that you now have. So I've been reading some natural history of the Great Lakes area, and you really get a sense of just how much information and analysis is now available because of these tools. So you're creating a record of what's here that's going to be valuable in 10, 20, 30 years, even without climate change.
Other questions or comments? Yeah, it's a great a great tool for a multiple host of users. So right now, if we wanted to access what is there, mm-hmm. is there a separate link or?
It's on the website. So if you put State Wildlife Action Plan in the DFW search page, it will come up, and you're able to download. Say you just want to look at the fact sheets to have a quick guide for, you know, the two pager for each species. You could download each one separate. You could do just the birds. You could do just the inverts. You know, and so it's each one's available.
Yeah. On the website, it's listed as I had it on the slide there, with each chapter listed independently. So the climate change, for example, is on is on chapter 5. You could just click on the climate change piece. You can go directly to one of the fact sheets.
Mm-hmm. And
the range maps.
The distribution, I mean, there isn't distribution because it's on the web, but the announcement of the availability of this will be... I mean, is there a plan for that to let people know that it's out there?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're really waiting for the Fish and Wildlife Service to approve the plan so that we can finalize. There's the chance that they might say, hey, we really want you to focus on this and provide these updates to it before we're able to finalize it and have it be our final version. So we're definitely working to kick that out and then, you know, offer up any potential webinars for the public or, you know, other outreach that needs to happen once that's available.
There's a lot of potential use of it. Commissioner Keenan.
I'm curious on especially on the maps and the habitat and the species. Do you feel that's can be brought down to a level of county or even farm, ranch, or field, you know, as a screening tool for conservation efforts or easements or any of those things that people are trying to make decisions on out in the field?
So the tool that we use for the sort of things you're talking about is mostly our priority and habitats and species information. I think it's got a slightly different, information that goes into those databases, right? So the range maps that you see are essentially modeling out based upon the habitat being there and what we know about our historical records of where we found them, it could be in these areas, right? So where we definitely want to focus conservation attention based on the habitat that's there and the info we have. As far as the regulation goes, it's based on a different data set that's more based on the certainty of where these species have been found in historically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we very deliberately titled those maps Potential Range and Habitat Distribution because it's largely an indication of where we think the animal could be. And so that's useful for a lot of different kinds of conservation planning, maybe not appropriate for any kind of a quote-unquote regulatory action. But it's one piece of the puzzle.
Anything else? Well, thank you, Penny. Thank you, Lynn. Well,